Thanks for being here. This is the kickoff of our fourth annual Media and Communication Summit, and thank you all for the great support you've given us to start our business. Today, I want to thank Christine McCarthy, the CFO and Senior Executive Vice President of The Walt Disney Company. We really appreciate Christine being here, kicking it off, as Disney did last year as well, so thanks for being here. We appreciate it. Given next week's opening of Pandora, the world of Avatar, let's start with theme parks. You're about to open this new attraction in Orlando's Animal Kingdom, and then 2 years later, you're going to open two new Star Wars attractions in California and Florida. What have you seen historically when you add new attractions or lands?
Thanks, Michael. We couldn't be more excited about the opening of Pandora, the world of Avatar. It opens next week and down in Orlando, and it's been a project that's been in the works for a while, and it's something we very much are looking forward to. But one of the things that we look at is every time we do a park expansion or a project in a park, it tends to be unique and driven by different things. But some of the elements of the things that we look for are pretty consistent. We look to make our park destinations must-see destinations. We also look for projects that we believe can not only drive new attendance but can drive increased attendance through repeat visitation. We also look at improving guest spending, and you'll see that in things like per caps. We also look at extending length of stay, and most importantly, we look at improving the guest experience because that's really key to getting repeat visitation for our consumers and guests to want to come back again and again. So when we look at all of those, we believe that Pandora, which is a 10-acre immersive land, and when I say immersive, you go in and you feel like you're in the world of Pandora. There are a couple of key E-type ticket attractions, but in addition to that, you have dining, retail, entertainment, and merchandise that's themed to the land. So all of that comes together to make a very, very attractive and compelling experience.
And the Star Wars.
Oh, and Star Wars. And the other thing I'd like to mention on Pandora. So if you're looking for what does it do, and I think sometimes you look in the past and you say, what experience is analogous to it? And the one that's most analogous to it is in 2012 when we opened Cars Land at Disney's California Adventure. Very similar type immersive experience. It went into a park that uplifted the park. We had an immediate increase in attendance, and a lot of that attendance was very sustainable. What it also did in California Adventure is it balanced more of our load, our guest visitation, across the two parks. And we expect that same kind of phenomenon to be apparent with Disney's Animal Kingdom, that this will draw more people into Animal Kingdom and will better balance the load throughout Walt Disney World.
Okay.
So Star Wars lands. We also have those coming soon. And the Star Wars lands, we have two. There will be one in Anaheim, one in Orlando. They're 14 acres. And at 14 acres, they will be the largest single-themed addition to any park we've ever had. They too will be immersive, and you will feel like you are in Star Wars. Once again, the same array of dining, retail, entertainment, merchandise, and also a lot of characters that'll be walking around, so you will really feel like you're there. And there are a couple of attractions, and they're probably these two I'd like to mention because I think there's probably some Star Wars fans in the room. One of the attractions allows people to take control of the Millennium Falcon, and the other puts you into a battle between the First Order and the Resistance. So these are things that people who love the Star Wars universe are really going to find compelling. We believe that these will also drive significant increased attendance that we believe will be sustainable in both the Hollywood Studios, where the Orlando Star Wars is going, as well as in Disneyland, where the Anaheim Star Wars will be.
Is there an analogy? You gave us the analogy of the Cars Land analogy, which was really great for Avatar. Is there an analogy for the Star Wars expansion? You could think of something that big that's been added?
I think you could think of it as that on steroids because the fan base is so significant and so loyal to the Star Wars universe, there will be people who probably have never been to one of our parks that this will bring them in.
Okay. Okay, so a year ago when Bob was here, he shared a pre-opening video of the Shanghai Disney Resort. Now that's open, how has the park performed versus initial expectations?
Yeah, I don't know how many of you were here last year and saw Bob's video, but if you did, or if you've been to our park in Shanghai, I think you'll note that what we call authentically Disney and distinctly Chinese. And the translation of that is you know that you're in a Disney park, but you also know that you're in China. So there's things about that park that are very unique to the park, but it also incorporates a lot of our Disney IP. So when we look at how the park has performed to date, we couldn't be happier. It's performed above expectations. And I think a lot of people in this room probably want to think about, you know, profitability. And two of the last three quarters, so it would be our fiscal fourth quarter as well as this most recent quarter, were profitable. And you'll see some seasonality for attendance in China that's related to just their school holidays and Chinese New Year. So fourth quarter, you'll have the peak holiday season. And in second quarter, you'll have Chinese New Year. So those will be the two highest attendance quarters. When we think about some of the learnings and some of the things that we expected or surprised us, I wouldn't say there's anything that's a big, you know, there was nothing that was a big surprise. But one of the things was where the attendance was coming from so far. We had thought it would be more of a local Shanghaiese population that would be visiting. And so far, two-thirds of the visitors have been from outside of Shanghai. So we find that very encouraging because it makes the park not just a local Shanghai park, but something that's much more national in scope and in desire to visit. That's also driven a very high occupancy level at our hotels. And in those hotels, we've been able to get above expectation ADRs and revenue. So those are all good things.
Right. One of the questions we asked last year, and I think it was too early to find out, was how would the park leverage other parts of Disney franchises? So what type of benefits are you seeing to maybe films, Disney films in China, and any CP sales in China due to the park business?
Yeah, this is, you know, having the park presence is significant, and it allows us to once again keep some of our franchises fresh and in the minds of consumers. One film I just would like to point out that was released in China and did extremely well was Zootopia. It did $235 million at the Chinese box office. Those furry characters are extremely popular in China. And when you see our parades, they're very prominent. So this is something that really resonates with the Chinese guest. And that's just one example of understanding what they really like and what appeals to them and really, you know, making it alive and relevant.
Okay, let me take you to something more near term, which is your last earnings call. You said on the last call that you expect Q3 parks costs to increase meaningfully. Can you help us quantify and the increase and discuss the drivers of what's happening in the current third quarter?
Sure. So in our parks business, I think you've seen that we've made a lot of investments to drive growth. And we've also been managing our expense growth. You've seen the combination of those two in the strong margin improvement the last few quarters. So when we look at the third quarter specifically, we do have both increases in underlying volume and new attractions that are coming online. With new attractions, we have expenses. Those expenses will be pre-opening, operational, sales, and marketing. And three that are in this quarter are Pandora, as we've talked about, also Guardians of the Galaxy, Mission Breakout, which is in Anaheim. It's at Disney's California Adventure. It is a totally reimagined Tower of Terror. If you've been to Disneyland or DCA, you know that we have Tower of Terror. It doesn't look like that anymore. It is a Guardians of the Galaxy attraction. And it's coming very close to the opening of our Guardians movie. And this is another thing that we think will draw new guests in and have repeat visitation. The third new attraction that opened earlier this quarter was Explorer's Lodge, and that is our third hotel in Hong Kong. That's a 750-key themed hotel, and that too came online, so you have some expenses associated with that. The third thing that is going to impact this quarter's growth is a full year of operation in Shanghai. So this is the first third quarter where you have a full quarter of operating expense. And the last one I'd like to mention is we have an 18-day dry dock of the Disney Fantasy. Disney Fantasy was launched in 2012, so this is the first time it's going into dry dock. So when you take all of those together, the growth year over year, we expect to be high single digits to possibly low double digits in expense growth. I'd also note that some of the, quite a few of these expenses are related to new attractions coming online. But you'll also have some things that will be recurring, and that'll be things like Shanghai, because Shanghai's up and operating.
Right, okay. Thank you. So let's turn to, we're going through all the divisions. Next is studio. Over the past 3 years, Disney's film studio, based on our math, sourced 60% of the film industry's profitability. It's amazing. And the question we have is, it's a business that's always been historically known as, you know, risky, you know, you can't guarantee success. So how have you been able to continue that success over 3 years in a tough industry, and have you been able to make that happen both financially and creatively? So what's different about your past three-year process maybe other people are not realizing?
Thank you for that question. Our studio has been on a great run for the last 3 years, both creatively and financially. So there's a couple things that distinguish our studio from others, and they are great IP and a sound strategy. So some of the things I'd like to call out, when you look at our acquisitions that have been in the IP space and how they've impacted our studio business, first was Pixar. And all of these acquisitions I'm going to talk about, they are similar in many ways, but they also have some unique elements. The similarities are great IP, really good creative talent, as well as strong management. But when we look at Pixar, we all know Pixar's track record. It's been great. And one of the things that we were able to get with that acquisition was also a really strong creative management team in John Lasseter and Ed Catmull. And at the time we did the Pixar acquisition, our Disney animation, Disney feature animation, wasn't performing up to the expectations that we had. Excuse me. So what we did was Ed Catmull and John Lasseter, in addition to running Pixar, also worked with the Disney animation team and really reinvigorated their process. And over that period of time, they had increasing successes with their animated films. And I'll just point to two recent ones, and I think you'll agree that it has been successful. Frozen and, I'm not drawing a blank, Zootopia. Frozen and Zootopia. Two extraordinarily successful movies, and they're also Oscar winners. So when you look at the Pixar acquisition, it really, really, not just Pixar, but also reinvigorated our Disney animation. Touching for a moment on Marvel, Marvel's IP, we know that the library of characters is extraordinarily deep. And many people know those characters through our films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And those are things that appeal to a wide, you know, they're four quadrant films. So they're not only male skewing, they also appeal to women and children and people of all, you know, ages and sizes. So that's another one. And Lucas, I think we can all agree, had what is probably one of the most iconic brands in film history in the Star Wars universe. And since we have acquired Lucasfilm, we've released two films, The Force Awakens back in December 15, did extraordinarily well. I think it was the third all-time best box office global on a global basis. And this past December, we released Rogue One. Coming December of 17, we have The Last Jedi, which will be episode 8, and following that we'll have Han Solo. So you'll see a series of Star Wars movies that'll work through our film release slate for many, many years to come. So when you look at the acquisitions and the impact they've had on us, since the Pixar acquisition, so we're including Pixar, Marvel, Lucas, and also the reinvigorated Disney animation, we've released 33 films, that have averaged $800 million in global box office. So when you look at it, that's what it's really done for our studio.
With also a low degree of failure rate, because what blows you up in any given quarter is a bomb, right? And you've not had, from that catalog, mm-hmm. very many problems getting your movies to a certain threshold at box office.
Well, that's a good point, but you know, we believe our strategy is very sound. But we also know that no studio is immune to a miss. So I don't want to say we're perfect, but we certainly try to be, but you just never know. But we do our best. The strategy we have of creating branded franchise films that are tent poles is very important. And we've also reduced the number of films on an annual basis that we release. On average, it'll be about 10. So some years it'll be more, some years it'll be less. This year, fiscal 17, we have 7 movies. In fiscal 18, we plan to release 11 movies. So if you look at, what is that 10 movies composed of, in general, you'll see 1 to 2 Star Wars, 2 to 3 animated movies, and they could be from both Pixar and feature animation, 2 to 4 Marvel movies. We do have 4 next year that are being released. And the balance will be filled in by Disney live action. Now, let me touch on Disney live action for a moment. Since 2014, we've also changed our strategy for Disney live action, and we're getting more and more towards reimagining Disney IP in the live action format. We've done 7 movies. The first one in 2014 was Maleficent, and the most recent was Beauty and the Beast. And if you look at those 7 films, they averaged $650 million at the box office. So that strategy of reimagining IP in a live-action format has also worked very well for us.
Okay, can you talk a bit, this is a current debate that we have all the time, can you talk about how you monetize your films through their various windows and discuss your thoughts on premium video on demand and, mm-hmm. and whether or not it's going to happen?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk recently about premium video on demand, but let's just talk for a moment about the windows. The windows that we have are very similar to any studio. After release, the home entertainment window is typically first, and that'll be both physical as well as digital distribution of the film, followed on by VOD. And typically next is the pay TV window, followed by free TV. And in the free TV window, you also have sales to basic cable. So that's the kind of sequencing of the windows that's followed for most movies. As it relates to premium VOD, because our strategy is releasing films that are tent poles, they're branded 4-quadrant tent poles, many of our movies are seen as events. There's a lot of social media leading up to the releases. A lot of people get invested in the characters through our trailers. Some of our trailers have been the most downloaded trailers. You've seen all those kinds of statistics recently. But when we release, we believe, and I believe our consumers believe, that our movies are best seen on a big screen. And definitely, initially, and we'd like them to see it on a big screen 2 or 3 times, but because of that, we don't feel that we should be moving our movies off of the big screen any sooner than they currently are. So while premium VOD is probably a strategy that does work for other studios, given their films and genres, for the kinds of films that we do, we're not engaged in conversations on premium.
Okay. Turning to consumer products. Can you talk a bit about consumer product performance in the first half of the year and what do you expect for the rest of the year? So it's been a bit of a lagging category. I know even in the past 3 quarters or so, it has not been as consistent as it was for, let's say, 13 to 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. So what's happened and what do you expect for the rest of the year?
Sure. Great question, and I'd like a moment to step back and just talk about our consumer products business to put things in perspective. So if we go back to a 4-year period, 2013 to 2016, our consumer products business has doubled in operating income, going from about $1 billion to $2 billion over that 4-year period. So I just want to this is a business that has grown has had very strong growth over a 4-year period. In the first half of this year, back in November, we said that our consumer products business was going to have a very, very tough comp to first quarter of 16. The reason being, we still had strong frozen merchandise sales, and we had the first Star Wars release that hit in the first quarter of 16. In addition to Star Wars merchandise, we also had a licensed game by the name of Battlefront. So all of that was in our consumer products number. The first quarter of this year, compared to first quarter of 16, we were down 25%. And we pretty much said we were going to be down over 20%. So the first quarter, the first half comp has been very difficult. And the growth for the year would be, if it was a year-over-year growth, it would be driven by the second half. Now, while we expect a very good, strong growth, meaningful growth in both the third and the fourth quarter, that will come from merchandise sales related to two upcoming films, Cars 3, which will release in June, and Spider-Man in July. So right now, we're about, I don't know, 6-7 weeks into the third quarter, and where we are now, I would say that we don't, if we're just saying we don't believe that we could that the second half, including the third and fourth quarter, will, it may not be sufficient to have growth for the full year. So it's just that the first half was tough. Second quarter half will be good with strong growth in 3 and 4, but it may not be sufficient for full year growth.
And on that point, how important are new film releases to driving growth in CP&A given the year? Given what you have coming in 18 and 19, what should we take away from the pipeline? How important is that to the overall growth of CP?
Well, film releases are, you know, they have been important to the growth, especially when you look at some of the content that has come through acquisitions with Marvel and with Lucas, with Star Wars. But any given year can be impacted by a film release, but our underlying franchises, we have 11 franchises that generate over $1 billion in retail sales. And among the strongest, the largest, is actually Mickey and Disney standard characters. So this is a business that has a very strong base of IP. And on top of that, we have film releases which add to the franchises. And when you look at these franchises, you know, Disney has a unique way of monetizing and distributing our content throughout our company, across the world. And we're able to keep these franchises alive for a long period of time. And that's unique to Disney.
And, you know, it's funny. Frozen was a surprise in terms of Frozen was. I remember when Frozen came, and then all of a sudden the CP followed.
Mm-hmm.
So Frozen's coming in 19. You think it's going to be a different? It has to be a different sequence this time around as people anticipate Frozen at retail.
Sure. You know, Frozen. There's a couple things that are upcoming for Frozen. Frozen is one of those franchises that is very appealing to young children. They love the music, and if any of you have children, you've probably heard those songs many, many times. But we have a stage play coming in 18 to Broadway, and in 19 there will be a sequel to Frozen. So people are anticipating that, but we can keep Frozen alive in our theme parks, not only in the stores and not only at retail, but in our theme parks, you know, on our channels. And when the movie comes in, and the movie comes out, people haven't forgotten about it. So, and that'll be about a 6-year window between the original and the sequel.
And the movie's in the fourth, is the calendar fourth quarter. Is it Christmas quarter?
Yeah.
I have more, but just to remind everyone, we do take questions, and Tracy, in about 10 minutes, will collect, 15 minutes, will collect questions from the audience, and I'll ask Christine the question. So people want to write questions, in 10, 15 minutes, we'll collect them. This is not a news flash for anyone in this room, that brick and mortar retail is struggling as e-commerce grows. How has Disney weathered that trend, and how are those stores positioned to succeed going forward given their retail footprint?
Yeah, this is not a newsflash, is right.
Yeah.
I think anyone who follows consumer trends and retail sales has seen that physical retail, call it brick and mortar, call it physical retail, is challenged just with changing consumer consumption habits. Our global footprint for our stores business is 350 stores. That has been, over the last decade, the store count has reduced by 30%, and it's actually down more than 50% since 2000 when we had our peak store count. We look at optimizing our footprint, rationalizing the way we're addressing this business, looking at how we're designing our stores to make them a compelling consumer experience, to have people want to come in. In general, our stores are smaller than they used to be, and not only are they smaller, but they have new IP, incremental IP that we've picked up with acquisition. So the way the stores are laid out is different than they were, a decade ago. And we also, when you look at our stores, the locations of them keep our franchises and our name in front of consumers. So people can't go to a Disney park every day, every week, every month. But if you're in a location and your kids or you are big Disney fans, you can go to a store and you're kind of surrounded by, the IP and the franchises. So while we'll still rationalize and address this business on a physical basis, we are also investing more in e-commerce and really looking at the direct-to-consumer channels.
Okay, let's go to media networks. We'll go to where everyone wants to talk about. You've always said, and Bob has always said, and people on the first rows have always said, the company likes its hand with ESPN. So what do you see that gives you that confidence to keep saying we like our hand at ESPN?
Well, Michael, I am so glad you asked that question because it's been such a long while since anyone asked us a question on ESPN.
Yeah.
So, ESPN is a business that we believe is attractive. We have compelling product. We are competitively advantaged. It is a business that we believe live sports has never been stronger, and live sports are now being viewed on ESPN through TV, mobile, over-the-top, digital, audio, and through streaming more than ever before. And some of the recent successes that we've had in live events, and I'm talking really recent, is the NBA playoffs. They're right now, and I'm glad to say my hometown team is still in the playoffs. Guess which one that is?
The Knicks.
No,
I'm joking.
Okay. No, they would be the Boston Celtics. But the NBA playoffs, also the recent NFL draft had very strong ratings. And we're in the current MLB season, and we're getting good ratings out of Major League Baseball. So when you look at those, we believe that, that's compelling content that people want to see. And in fact, in the first calendar quarter, the ESPN audience on a year-over-year basis was up 15%. And when you include out-of-home viewing and ESPN watch viewership, that added another 10% lift to their audience. So those things, I think you would agree that, live sports is something that, viewers are going to come and view on ESPN. We also, and I know there's been a lot spoken about this, but, we believe we have the sports that people want to see. So when you look at the important national sports rights, we have more of those rights than all other sports media combined. And we do have some of those sports that we consider the most important: NFL, NBA, MLB, and really coveted college sports into the next decade. And we believe that that is a competitive advantage.
Yeah, and one of the things you've said for a few years is there's going to be more virtual MVPDs. So now we've seen explosion in virtual MVPDs. Can you talk a bit about how Disney's networks fare relative to the traditional distributor world and the virtual world?
Sure. Now, I think, remind me to answer that question, but let me first say that our networks, our brands, consumer demand makes our networks compelling to put on these platforms. ESPN was not in some of the early skinny packages, but it is in the digital platforms, Sling, Sony View, DirecTV Now, YouTube TV, as well as Hulu. We are encouraged by what we see in those, in the adoption of those new platforms. I think it's fair to say these are nascent offerings. Many of these have come out in the last year, and two have come out, both YouTube and Hulu, have come out in the last, 6-8 weeks. Hulu just came out earlier this month, the first week in May. So we're very encouraged by what we see there. But once again, we're very bullish on the long term, but you do have to have some time to allow for consumer adoption. When you look at it on a per sub basis, being on these platforms is as good for us as it is on the traditional. So we view these as being great offerings that are important to us, as profitable for us. And what we like about these new platforms is they are user-friendly. The interfaces keep getting better and better. They're also mobile, and Bob Iger's talked a lot about the necessity for these platforms to be all of the three, user-friendly, great interface, and mobile-friendly. And when you combine those attributes with a lower price point, we believe that, you know, provides a very attractive alternative for consumers. So we're very bullish on this on the long run, and we're still in the early days.
Okay, so over the many years I've covered your company, it's always been easier to be bearish about ESPN's value to distributors when you're out of an affiliate renewal cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where we just debate the value of the future of ESPN. So when will the next refresh cycle start on the affiliate fee side?
So I think some of you know that we have a small renewal that will be at the end of this fiscal year. Our fiscal year ends September 30. So at the end of the fiscal year, we have a small renewal. That will start the renewal cycle. That renewal cycle will take a handful of years to work through the system. And when we look at, you know, what's important to us, we're not going to, you know, give you all the strategy that we have, but what's important to us when we look at these are not only the rate that our networks get, but how our rates are, how our networks are put on these platforms. And also it's really important to understand what the full entertainment experience is, what is the distributor going to provide to the consumer. So we think all of those are very important, but those are just very high level details, and there's a myriad of options and alternatives and things that are part of the negotiating strategy. And while I like you very much, Michael, and everyone in this room, we don't think now is the right time to talk about our negotiating strategy for these, but they are coming up.
We're providing guidance into the future, right? Yeah.
That's a good try, but no.
Okay. In the last round, you launched the SEC Network, and you established Watch ESPN as a paid service. What other products do you see? I know ACC is a network that is coming to the forefront, you know, possibly coming to the forefront. Mm-hmm. So how big can ACC be, or is ACC one of the products you're trying to establish along the way?
Well, I think during these, you know, ACC is not yet launched, but it's coming up. During this round of negotiations, the negotiating team will try to get full distribution, as we did with the SEC Network.
Okay. If there's a legitimate concern about ESPN, it's on the changing consumer consumption patterns of sports news. So what are you doing at ESPN to shift its business model to deal with this trend of how all of us now get Boston Celtics news on our phones mm-hmm. the moment it happens?
It's a great question, and I don't think it's something that, you know, anyone hasn't already been thinking about. So news and information for sports, consumers have changed the way they consume it, and I have a prop. So this is used a lot for news and information. So mobile phones, mobile devices are used a lot for news and information. ESPN has been a leader in mobile, and they've created very innovative projects products for their digital platforms. They have continued to do things like, you know, rationalize their apps, combine their apps, look at engagement through their interface, through personalization, customization, use of video. That's key for sports fans. And that is all, you know, what they have, you know, they've been working on and increasing their integration across all of their platforms. So news and information is something that is changing, and ESPN has been addressing that change for several years now. And another thing I just want to talk about is SportsCenter. So there's been also a lot of talk about SportsCenter, and one of the things that we've done, and it really started about 18 months ago, is we've looked at branded personality-driven segments of SportsCenter. So 18 months ago, we launched Scott Van Pelt's at the 12 midnight hour. And since that time, his show has done very well. And in fact, it's the number one show in his time slot for males 18 to 34. And that's competing against, you know, some late night TV. Right. So that's a very appealing demographic. We've also recently launched in the 6 p.m. hour a personality-driven show with Michael Smith and Jemele Hill. And just yesterday, we announced at the Upfront, ESPN's Upfront, that Sage Steele will be going to Bristol and doing the morning Sports Center 7 to 10. And we'll also have what we believe is a really good 11 p.m. Sports Center that'll have rotating anchors with some of our four best-known anchors, including the very engaging and sometimes irreverent Kenny Mayne. So he'll be part of that. And that's the lead-in to Scott Van Pelt. So we are addressing Sports Center and really changing it from a news and information to more personality-driven segments.
Okay. Trace, you want to collect them? I'll keep asking questions. Since you've been CFO, you really stepped up the buyback efforts of the company. So how do you balance the need to invest in internal growth versus the return of capital to shareholders?
Sure. Since I've been CFO, our capital strategy has not changed. Before I was fortunate enough to be the CFO of Disney, I was the treasurer for 15 years. So I was very involved in our capital allocation strategy as well as the execution of it. So, you know, we haven't changed that. We've always taken a very disciplined and measured approach to capital. And the first and foremost, our priority is to invest in our businesses. It's investing in businesses where it's investing for growth and also new initiatives in some of those businesses that we believe can also not only drive growth but drive strong returns. So that's first and foremost. We also have, you know, over the years executed upon a very disciplined M&A strategy. That's also been part of our growth. And I think you see with the acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, Lucas, that those have been very successful and very well integrated into the company. So when you look at the strength of our balance sheet, which is strong, we've also been able to consistently return capital to shareholders. And we've done that through not only buybacks, but also dividends. And, you know, this is something that we view as, you know, a strength of the company. And just last week, we announced that we were going to increase our fiscal 17 share repurchase, which we had given sort of an expectation of it would be in the $7 to $8 billion range, that it will now be in the $9 to $10 billion range. And that, once again, just reinforces our confidence in our company as well as our long-term future.
Yeah, as a former treasurer, I don't know if you agree, but the company to us looks very underlevered. So given the stability of your cash flows, why not raise your debt level to something more in line with the rest of the media sector?
Well, that's a good question, and other people have brought it up from time to time.
Right.
But, you know, we do generate a lot of cash, Michael, and we do have a very strong balance sheet. We consider our balance sheet and our financial strength to be not just, you know, not just a strategic asset, but also a financial asset. And we have less leverage than the other media and entertainment companies. And that's really reflected when you look at the ratings differential, you know, in our company versus the other media companies. When we go to the capital market, the fixed income capital markets to raise debt, the fixed income market really looks at our peer group as being the large global branded companies. So we're not comped against the media sector. We're really comped against, you know, global branded company names. So that's just another differential. When we think about our balance sheet overall, we think about it providing flexibility, financial flexibility. We have been able to make long-term investments, commitments on our own balance sheet without, you know, structured financing to do it, but on our own balance sheet. And we've been able to do that through cycles. And so some of the projects that we had that began, you know, before the financial crisis, we were able to continue those projects. We didn't have to slow down. We just continued and completed them on our scheduled time frame. So that's very important. We're also able to, when we do go to market, we're able to raise debt at very attractive levels. We also, and I'll just quote one of the rating agencies that recently upgraded us, we have exceptional liquidity. And what's great about our liquidity is that that has also served us very well during periods of market stress. Okay. So hopefully we won't have to deal with things like we did a few years ago with the financial crisis, but we believe that we'll still have the same experience we did back then.
And you guys don't take film financing. That's one of the big differences. You own all. You don't have to go to third parties for film financing, so you own all your IP and don't share the outside with anyone.
Correct.
Okay, so I have some questions from the room. How important are global digital rights when negotiating TV contracts with the major U.S. sports leagues? So you only get the U.S. rights. I know with the NFL you've got some global rights, NBA mm-hmm. also. So can you give us a sense of how perhaps the global digital rights opportunity is now impacting your interest in negotiating new deals?
Yeah. When you look at sports rights, ESPN is primarily a domestic U.S. business. The other part of the world where they have a significant presence and significant sports rights is in Latin America. And we have various channels down there, you know, that are targeted towards, you know, the key sports, one of which we all know is football or soccer, but in baseball. There are other things that are down there, but Latin America, and then we have some license deals in other parts of the world. We have a deal in China, Tencent, with Tencent, and they've recently done other deals in Africa and in various locations, but we are primarily a U.S. A sports company.
Okay, and this would Disney ever consider bidding for digital sports rights instead of traditional linear rights? So I think recently was it UEFA Champions League? So, you know, with BAMTech in the background, how does the interest in digital rights appear to you with BAMTech and, you know, developing soon?
Sure, BAMTech was an investment. We should probably just mention. So, I believe it was about a year ago. Last August, we made an investment of $1 billion for about a third of BAMTech, and we do have the ability to increase ownership over time. And they will be launching a branded ESPN offering later this year, but they will be. We're not going to compete against them for digital sports rights, but that's certainly a possibility that, you know, we would be a participant as a current third owner in those. But you know, the world's changing, and ESPN, when they look at sports rights, and you know, when either we're looking at renewals and renegotiations or things that are out in the marketplace, they'll consider all things, and they'll look at the current environment and make the right decision.
A question that we get, and I'm sure you hear all the time, is why wouldn't it make sense to separate ABC ESPN from Disney CPG assets? Some people think it makes sense. So
there must be an investment banker in the room.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that's talked about. We have a fiduciary responsibility to look at things for shareholders, and we are very deliberate. And, you know, we look at a lot of things, and I think it's fair to say that we look at our businesses. We like the hand we have now. But, you know, we continue to look at our array of businesses and do what we believe is in the long-term best interest of shareholders.
Okay. ABC TV Studio, yesterday was the upfront. How do you balance selling outside to other networks versus only acquiring your ABC Studio content for ABC? And maybe turning around, how much of ABC's content is coming now from ABC's own production company?
Mm-hmm. So ABC, both ESPN and ABC had their upfronts yesterday. So ABC Studios is our in-house production studio, and I think over 60% of the shows that we picked up this year were ABC Studio shows, and I believe we have a piece of every show. There may be some co-produced shows in our new slate, but we have a piece in all of those. But we produce shows, and depending on, you know, our slate, when they put together the slate for the week, when they look at, you know, whether it's a comedy, whether it's a drama, where it fits in the schedule, our entertainment people at ESPN will make a decision whether or not it makes sense, and also for the viewership that we have, if it makes sense for our viewership. And some shows that we produce, you know, we own them, but they actually, you know, do quite well on other networks. One example that's been for several years on the air is Criminal Minds. That's a very successful show for CBS, but we own it. So that's just one example. And there are a few shows that that were produced this year that other networks picked up. But we do get first look, and we'll make the decision if we think it's right for our network and right for the schedule that we are putting out to the marketplace.
Okay, going back to virtual bundles, you expressed confidence that they'll be incrementally positive for the affiliate fee business, affiliate revenues and the industry going forward. Now that YouTube and Hulu have been in the market for 1 to 2 months, have they been sufficient to reverse the acceleration, or is it too early and it's not when? And perhaps your visibility is not, you guys are not up to the, yeah. So you want to talk a bit about how much you see and how quickly
right.
it's helping?
You know, I think the question is really, you know, do you believe that the adoption of the digital MVPDs will be sufficient to offset the loss of traditional cable? That's the basic question. I would say we certainly hope so, but, you know, these just came to market. They just came to market. You know, people, you know, I'm sure they're going to talk about them. They're going to go online. They're going to talk to their friends. Do you like it? What do you like about it? What do you not like about it? I think it's really too early to tell. But, you know, we have seen good adoption, which, you know, initial adoption, early days. And when you have these digital MVPDs, you know, you got to look at the adoption, and also you have to look at the churn. And we're hoping that these new products are compelling enough for those who choose to use them, that they'll keep them, and that the churn will be down and the adoption will continue to rise. They are a lower price point, so we believe that they will appeal to people that may not have traditional cable. They may be young, they may be getting out of school, they may have just moved out from their parents, and they may look at this as a good alternative. So I think, you know, we are optimistic, but we're also realists, and time will tell.
And this is, you know, this is a follow-up question. On the last call, and all calls really, the company's always been very open about what you're seeing in the business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you invest in a BAMTech, and you've been behind virtual MVPDs. Is there a plan B? Is there a plan B, or is this plan? Is there another plan? People wanted to know if the trends don't stabilize, or is this the plan B to what was used to be plan A, which was just the business is the business.
Boy, that's a complicated question.
Yeah.
Look, I think where we are now in the cycle, these digital MVPDs have just been launched. And when I say just, I mean, I came out of the banking industry for many years, and I remember way back when ATMs came on, and, you know, people were kind of afraid of them. And, like, you know, over time, I think everybody uses an ATM now. Adoption will occur, and I think it'll occur much faster because people are a lot more tech savvy. They know how to, you know, download things. They're going to sample. A lot of millennials love to sample things. So I think right now, where we are in the evolution of the media business, the digital MVPDs, you know, we'll see how they work. Now, something else may come. I don't know what that'll be. If there was a magic holy grail someplace, I think we'd all be jumping on horses and going to the pilgrimage. But we don't know. And right. I think, you know, we have great minds and people thinking about this. It's a topic we think about all, you know, daily. And we'll see how these work. And, you know, and I'm sure there will be iterations and modifications that'll come to the market. But right now, I'd say give them a chance in the digital MVPDs.
Right, and I would say the last question to wrap it up is, you know, when you allocate your capital, your allocation of capital has produced pretty good returns away from media network business, right? So there's been a long-term strategy to invest behind the whole Disney balance sheet and the whole Disney, you know, operating divisions just around them, not only around media networks, right?
So when sure.
So the ROIC improvement at Disney is coming away from, you know, the other businesses are kicking in.
Oh, yeah.
Much more higher incremental ROIC.
I think, you know, in closing, our businesses are, when you look at our studio business, our consumer products business, our theme park business, they are all very strong. There is, you know, a linkage between all those businesses that's IP related. And once again, when you think about what makes Disney unique versus other companies in the media and entertainment world, it's the fact that we can take our IP and we can use it, monetize it, keep it alive, keep the franchises alive through that whole Disney ecosystem. So when you look at that, that has really resulted in improved and very, I would say, very attractive levels of return on capital.
Okay. Christine, thank you. Thank you all. We appreciate the support. And we have another two coming up right after this. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.